Well, what a roller coaster year it's been. In this Christmas roundup, we're looking back over our 2022 podcasts and pulling out some top insights for you to reflect on over your mince pies. We hope you enjoy it. Two big issues for health this year have been the cost of living crisis and, of course, political turmoil. Our April pod, Will the Cost of Living Be Paid For by Our Health?, featured Claire Moriarty, the Chief of Citizens Advice Bureau, and Bim Afolami, Conservative MP for Hitchin and Harpenden. With people having to choose between heating and eating, how much could government do? Here's Bim.
I think that what is really, really hard about a wholesale rise in energy prices that are many, many times greater than we've seen since the oil shock of 1973 is that the government can't make everyone whole. The government can't be in a position where we just keep prices for everybody at the price that it was, I don't know, 18 months ago, a year ago. That is just not a feasible scenario.
Claire Moriarty's response was strong.
I suppose my response to that would be, of course, the government can't make everyone whole, but it shouldn't leave people broken, because it's morally wrong to leave people broken, and it's economically wrong if we don't address issues that are leaving people with just impossible choices to make. That is going to turn up in all sorts of different ways that will need to be addressed. We have to recognise and respond to the plight of people who don't have options in terms of cutting back on spending in particular areas, who've got to the point where they have pared back everything and they are having to do things which we would all recognise are they're wrong. People shouldn't have to turn off the heating and not be able to, bath their children and be in a state of constant anxiety because they just don't have enough money to make ends meet for reasons which, are not, this is not people's fault. We're all living in this very extraordinary situation, but as a society, we need to look after people who are in the least good circumstances.
And as Claire pointed out later in an inspiring interview with Nick Robinson on his BBC pod Political Thinking, while the government has in the autumn statement agreed to uprate benefits with inflation, that only kicks in next April. There's a whole winter to get through before then. It's really worth a listen if you haven't already. So continuing on population health, how interested is national government in repairing the fraying health fabric? Rachel Wolfe from Public First, who co-authored the Conservatives' 2019 election manifesto, gave us a dose of realism in our autumn pod.
Short-term fixes are going to dominate the next 2 years. So things that are major inputs into preventative health, changing people's lifestyles, things that are long-term and difficult and multifaceted, you're much more likely to see progress, I think, after an election than you are now.
And Richard Sloggett, who was at one point Matt Hancock's special advisor, agreed in our pod about risk factors to health.
I think when you're sitting in government, you are trying to sort of balance the kind of different interests and the different views and trying to work out what the art of the possible is with regards to public health policy. And that is not an easy thing. So when it comes to the Prevention Green Paper, for example, we were constantly trying to work out how far can we realistically go, given the political mandate that we had. And the political mandate, frankly, when I was in government, was very limited. We were dealing with the Brexit challenges, of course, in particular. So moving the needle on public health policy at the national level, it involves a number of different interests and trying to manage some of those political issues, which is not easy or straightforward.
7 months on, that sounds like a distinct understatement. But if national government can't or won't act, don't lose hope. Enter local government. Here's how Regional Director of Public Health for London, Kevin Fenton, responded to Richard.
And perhaps a question for us is, how do we build those coalitions in the years ahead as we emerge from the pandemic so that we learn from the successes in HIV and in tobacco and apply them to other health improvement areas as well? So I agree with you on the importance of national leadership, but there's also an opportunity here for place and coalitions, I think. So we do have opportunities here to perhaps go a little bit further than national government is doing, to pilot some of the innovation and then work at scale in place as part of what I think we need to be doing to tackle some of these issues.
Which sounds hopefully like act and ask for permission later. That's the spirit, Kevin. Given the need for economic growth, you might think that with a spike in the number of economically inactive people, a lot due to ill health, that might spur national government to more action. Did you know there are 600,000 more people of working age who are economically inactive after the pandemic compared to before it? That's a population the size of the city of Manchester just taken out of the economy. And two-thirds of this increase are people over 50. We covered this last month with award-winning Financial Times journalist Sarah O'Connor and economist James Banks. Here's James defining the issue.
But if you look at the people who say they're inactive for health reasons, a lot of them have been out of work for quite a long time, like even 5 years or more, certainly, you know, 3 or 4 years or more. And so one scenario is that actually it's the work itself or the lack of work that has been causing their health and their ability to work to deteriorate. You know, we haven't spoken about the reverse, if you like. The effect, you know, work can be good for your health and the lack of work can be bad for your health. You've really got to look at what they were doing in the past rather than just the jobs of the most recent retirees. Having said that, you know, what we know typically about the way inactivity is patterned across the job and the income distribution is that we have this inverse U-shape. So we have kind of the most inactivity both at the bottom of the skill distribution and at the top of the skill distribution. So you get sort of, you know, wealthy early retirees or people post-pandemic who have got enough to live on, but they might not be the wealthiest in society, but they've just decided, you know, I just don't want to sort of do the same kind of work anymore.
Yeah.
And then at the bottom end, you've got a sort of low skill, poor job, health constrains your ability to work.
So just why are older people leaving the workforce? A recent study of the over 50s across Germany, the UK and America found that we stood out as having more negative attitudes to work, particularly since the pandemic. Sarah O'Connor wasn't surprised.
So people report that they're working harder, they're working faster, they're working to tighter deadlines. And then combined with that, and this is the bit that is kind of troubling from a health point of view, you're seeing a sort of fall in the amount of autonomy that people have over their work. So far fewer people today, particularly lower paid people, say that they can make their own decisions about the way that they do things, or indeed the pace at which they do things. And there's a huge kind of wealth of literature that shows that that is a very toxic combination for your health, working very hard, very fast to tight deadlines, while also not having much control over the work. So that was all happening before the pandemic. And in many ways, I think the pandemic sort of intensified that. And then if you were an essential worker, you were working very hard to try and meet people's needs during this time, while also taking on quite a lot of personal risk for your health, which you were then worrying about for your family. So when you add all of that together, it kind of doesn't surprise me at all that basically a lot of people are feeling exhausted and stressed and burned out.
Not surprising then that businesses and investors are noticing that health is linked to productivity and wealth, and of course a labour shortage. So what to do about it? One responsibility is of course down to the government. And here's Sarah again.
The UK is sort of unusually bad at enforcing its own labour laws. I mean, we have a kind of a pretty lightly regulated labour market anyway. But even within that, we don't have very many labour market inspectors for the number of workers that we have. We've got a very sort of fragmented system of looking after workers. But the fundamental problem is that we just don't really resource this properly. You basically have a scenario where quite a lot of employers can act with impunity. And the perfect example of that would be the textile trade in Leicester, which I wrote about a few years ago. I mean, you know, an entire mini economy there where the going wage is about £4 an hour, even though the minimum wage is double that. And that's out in the open. Everyone knows it. Every now and then, when the media exposes it, the enforcement bodies go in and have a go at sorting it out. But actually, they've never really got to grips with it.
But clearly, businesses and investors also have a role. Here's Catherine Howarth from ShareAction in our pod from last January.
There is an opportunity, I think, to make the case to government that actually mobilising the investment community and mobilising the business community to address the causes of public health challenges, for example, by addressing the diet of the nation and making sure that companies are operating in a responsible way in terms of nutrition and diet, that's a real opportunity for government to avoid spend, if you like, and to avoid public spend. So I think there's a business case to be made, there's a fiscal case to be made, if you like, to government on this. And there's also, of course, a need for concerted, coordinated and creative campaigning that builds the political pressure for things like the levelling up agenda to take health seriously.
Yes, remember levelling up. In the same episode, here's John Godfrey, former head of Number 10's policy unit under Prime Minister May, and now working for one of the biggest investors in the UK, Legal & General.
There is a real hook here for government in the levelling up agenda, because it is in many ways shocking that some of the towns and cities that most need levelling up also in health terms. My advice would be to set up a series of nudges, if you like, and then make sure that businesses and investors actually do respond in a self-interested way. And part of that is about risk management. If you're investing in something, you want that investee company to get ahead of any changes that might impact them through regulation, through legal action, through tax changes and so on, whether that's about sugar or alcohol, just as it was about cigarettes. So I think that self-interest point is important, and government should set a framework.
Well said, John. And what about the public? If businesses, investors, national and local government have a role, how much interest is there in communities to take control and act on their own health? In June, I interviewed Councillor Jackie Dyer, Chief of Black Thrive, which is a community organisation based in Lambeth.
We're having community groups much more engaged in helping us to shape the interventions or the support that they require, because they are co-producing, they are involved in identifying what the response needs to be in order to support them. So, for example, accessing peer support and culturally appropriate advocacy is a service that's been co-designed with communities to give them the support that they actually need when they're experiencing that kind of vulnerability. And so that helps to change the narrative around how services kind of manifest, that they can be better at meeting the needs of diverse populations because those diverse populations are helping to shape them.
And there was more hope from fellow guest John Hume, who runs a charity dedicated to local action to reduce health inequality. Here's John explaining how to unlock progress.
I would say that with the communities that we work with, their initial response to what health means would almost certainly always be about the NHS. Mm. But I think that once you're clear that what you don't mean are the major killers and you don't mean the NHS, and once those communities feel really confident that actually what you're not doing is judging them, I think they really quickly open up. And this is, you know, I think it's particularly the case for communities that have got significant disadvantage, where class, race, you know, material disadvantage is a factor. I think you rarely get people talking about health in a way which is about disease. They might start off about that, but really what they start to talk about is the housing, the lack of jobs, the low pay. Yeah. And they talk about, you know, people being in poorer schools or no places for their kids to play, and really often about bygone industry which hasn't been replaced.
It's all connected, isn't it, John? Changing tack, of course, a big preoccupation this year has been with the NHS and social care, for understandable reasons. Seasoned former Health Minister Norman Warner rehearsed some of the challenges back in May.
I don't remember a time like this in terms of what the situation is for both the health and care sectors. I think they're in a very bad place with some very serious risks. And the reason why I think they've got into this state is what has happened over the last 10 years. It's had a devastating effect, not just on the NHS, but public services more generally. And what you've seen over the last 10, 12 years is the impact of funding austerity, in our case, health and care, serious neglect of the social care area. But people don't talk very much about it.
So what to do? Norman went on.
My own view is that you need something radical. We don't need to keep contemplating new research. We need to actually take some action which puts the money into the development of community-based services. And I, if I was still a minister, I would actually be putting a proposition to the Treasury, which would say that we need to use capital money and treat the workforce issues in health and care as an infrastructure project.
Yeah.
In which we're going to actually, for 10 years, we're going to invest in developing that workforce and the buildings that, and equipment that, that those people will work with. Anything short of a 10-year transition program for community services, I think, is just doomed to failure.
Well, I'll drink to that. But wait, does the government have the appetite or the bandwidth? Here's Rachel Wolfe again.
You have to understand that the Conservative Party, above all else, really likes winning elections. And the one of the first things you realise or are brought to realise when you work for the Conservative Party is you cannot win an election if the public think that you're going to cut or deeply damage the NHS. You cannot do it. But that doesn't mean there won't still be a battle of ideas between the right and the left on the NHS, because it is a huge part of our state. And I think a very large number of the thinkers on the right worry about its structure, its levels of expenditure, its performance. That will keep happening. But I'd be astonished if it drove her big political choices.
I was very reassured to hear that, not least because of the blood-curdling copy by commentators in the right-wing press this year on the NHS and need for reform. The Spectator's Isabel Hardman agreed with Rachel Wolfe.
You've got think tanks, reformers, commentators, august publications such as my own, pushing for change, and the government of the day saying, well, look, we have an NHS backlog that could kill us politically anyway. Is now really the time to also scrap the health service? I mean, you know, in terms of falling off voters' Christmas card lists, I think the Tories have got enough to worry about anyway.
Ah, that's okay then. In any case, there's a dearth of reform ideas coming forwards, apart from the usual tropes, such as cutting the number of bureaucrats. By the way, the NHS has low numbers compared to other countries. Or let's import a new financing system, e.g. from Germany. But of course, not the level of financing which we can't or won't afford. So it was interesting to compare ourselves to Germany in the pod called A Tale of Two Hospitals back in July. In it, Tim Orchard, Chief Executive of Imperial College Healthcare NHS Trust, and Heo Kromer, Chief Executive of Germany's largest hospital, the Charité in Berlin, were comparing their experience of managing hospitals in a pandemic. Remember that Germany spends 40% more per capita than the UK on healthcare, and has done for years. Here's Tim on some of the similarities.
I think the staff piece is quite similar. I completely agree with the comment about the psychological interventions. So we had sort of targeted counselling in and around areas where we knew we had particular issues. But I do think we will have a problem that will take some months or years really to unpack as people process these sort of very traumatic events in very different ways and on very different timescales. So I do think we've got that workforce issue. And of course, people who were nearing retirement are taking early retirement. So there's an issue about senior staff being lost from the sort of top end of the workforce. Mm. And I think nursing vacancy rates are clearly higher than we were. And of course, you then run the risk of getting into a bit of a vicious circle where you don't quite have enough staff. So the staff who are remaining are under more stress.
And Heo Kromer agreed.
We have a general shortage on the nurse side. And this is due to a major demographic change in Germany. And then people after these 2 years are in part really exhausted, changed or reduced their working hours and these type of things. So we are very much in the process trying to cope with that. We have a new and really very different contract with the unions in terms of organizing the work of the nurses, assessing once they get an overload and these type of things. So there are lots of efforts, but our main problem currently is really getting the workforce. And if you look in the entire workforce, the main problems are in the nursing part.
But here's the killer contrast to the UK from Heo.
On the other hand, If you really want a procedure in the country right now, you will get it. Maybe not exactly where you want and at the place you want, but you will get something because the overall coverage is still quite good. So
yes.
Waiting times, if you don't have a completely exceptional thing, this is manageable.
Yes, when you say manageable, what kind? How long would, I'm just interested, how long would you wait, say, for a hip replacement?
A hip replacement, I mean, you can get that. I would guess you can get a hip replacement within a week.
I think that's worth repeating, don't you? So let's hear it again.
I would guess you can get a hip replacement within a week.
That is what the extra investment buys. Please take note, media, politicians, think tanks and armchair would-be reformers. Another eye-watering contrast came from our August pod examining how to engage the huge medical talent on the shop floor in the NHS to get involved in management to improve care. Steve Swenson explained the rationale from the Mayo Clinic in the US.
If you look at the top-rated hospitals in America, 13 of the top 21 organizations in the country are led by physicians, and all of the top six are led by physicians. Quality is 25% higher than those run by non-physicians, if you look at the close to 6,000-some hospitals in America. And in the United Kingdom, you're probably aware of Castro and Richard Dunn's work. It's from 2008. But basically, they also found the same thing in the UK, is that there's a clear association between quality and to the extent which physicians contribute to the hospital management, about 20% higher financial and clinical quality scores than those that had fewer clinician leaders. So it's not just the CEO, it's physician leadership and clinician leadership up through the ranks.
So what does the Mayo do? Steve explained the so-called leadership dyad.
At Mayo, it's a physician-led organization, and the physicians partner with an administrator. The physicians still, everyone, all the way up to the CEO, still maintain a clinical practice, and they act as leaders. They don't act as managers. The administrators with the MBAs and the MHAs act as managers. 95% of our physician leaders don't have an MBA or equivalent, but they have the basic understanding of finance and accounting and law and human resources and et cetera, quality improvement. But their role is to be a leader of all the clinicians and in that big picture. And that allows them to, with this partnership with administrators, to still maintain a practice. And then we have this pipeline. So there are 5,000 some docs. We have 242 formal titled leadership positions for physicians that we monitor. And those include division department chairs, and includes the deans of education, practice, and research, all the way up to the CEO, 242 of those. And for each of those, we have a succession pool, the talent, the doctors that could be the next chair of surgery, or they could be the next dean of education. And if for each of those succession pools, we have a scorecard that rates them for readiness, competence, and ethnic diversity and gender diversity. So that we look at that from all the way up. So the pipeline to get someone who could be a dean someday or a CEO someday, those men and women physicians, they develop over 2 to 3 decades before they get to that top level in the organization. And so they know the culture, they get the social capital, and they have the competence.
Dr. Dominique Allwood, the Chief Medical Officer at UCL Partners, contrasted that with the NHS.
So we in the UK have a very different system, which I guess is focused on those medical managers doing both those roles together, or juggling at least in some variation of that. And I think that you find that you might get at the head of specialty, that kind of unit level, maybe 2 to 4 hours a week to do that management role. So you can see why that doesn't feel very attractive to a clinician who has anywhere between 10 and 40 clinicians to manage, direct reports to them, and a service. Of course, they have an administrator working alongside them, but they may be working across a range of different specialties. So I guess there's a sort of sense within the NHS that it's that sort of Buggins turn. So everyone looks around and says, well, I hope it's not going to be me. And the last person left sort of ends up stepping in. And so if you combine that with, I guess, no systematic way of trying to identify talent, we're left with this sort of vacuum of the role seems really hard and we don't have people lining up ready to do it, nor have they been encouraged or developed in advance of getting to that point. And so it does feel like we're often in a sort of crisis mode of looking around and trying to beg and borrow people to get into those roles.
So looks like we're missing a very big trick here, especially as most doctors spend the whole of their working life in the NHS. Finally, two positive messages from our remaining two pods of the year. The first was on dealing with drugs, contrasting the UK's approach with Portugal. Not long ago, Portugal had experienced the highest drug deaths in Europe, and now it is second lowest. How so? Because of 20 years of taking a public health approach rather than a criminal justice one to the problem. If you're caught in Portugal with less than 10 days' supply of drugs, you're not prosecuted, but instead directed to support units called commissions. These have made all the difference. Here's the mastermind behind it all, Dr. João Goulayo, Portugal's drug czar, explaining to Dame Carol Black and me.
Most of the people, the vast majority of the people who are referred to those commissions are not problematic users or are not addicted people in need of treatment. But even then, okay, I have no problems with drugs. I smoke a joint with my friends on weekends. But in the interview, you say, okay, my parents are divorcing, or my father just lost his job. Or myself, I am in balance with my gender choices or whatever. And the commission can, would you like to discuss it with a psychologist? Would you like to discuss the problems or to seek the support of the social services? And they refer and they open those gates. So this is how it works and why I think this system of dissuasion is really effective.
And other countries have surely taken notice.
We can see the national coordinators on drugs all over Europe are turning more and more to the Ministry of Health instead of the Ministry of Home Affairs or Justice as before. And I think in political terms, this is a clear sign of the centrality of the health and social side of the phenomenon instead of the punitive and the prosecution of it.
But as Dame Carol explained, her work in the UK had limits.
I couldn't look at anything which required a change in the law, so I couldn't look at either decriminalisation or indeed at legalisation, and that was made quite clear to me. So that what I tried to do in part two of my report was to put together a whole systems plan that would allow us to really start to treat drug addiction as a medical, a public health problem, a chronic condition. And I didn't believe you needed to change the law to do that. This is the way we, as a community, as a society, approach those very stigmatized individuals. We know from the evidence that high quality treatment and recovery will reduce drug taking, does reduce crime. So I suppose you could say I tried very hard to find a scheme that would allow us to try and do some of the very good work that has been done in Portugal, albeit with not using quite the same tools.
And very finally, it's a strange place to end, but one of our most popular pods this year was on death and dying. How to bring death back into everyday life was the theme, which was surprisingly uplifting. Here's Dr. Libby Salno, who helped on the Lancet Commission on Death and Dying, and its chair, Richard Smith. Libby talked about the huge interest in communities to support dying people. This was inspired by developments in Kerala, India, which had the first palliative care policy in the world explicitly involving the community, starting way back in 2008.
We saw lots of young people who were working locally, had moved to London, felt very disconnected just staying in a flat and really wanted to be part of the local community. We saw many older people who wanted to share the experiences that they'd had of caring for people and supporting people. We had lots of young mothers who felt they had time in the day. And I mean, it was hugely different. And what we saw in East London, which is obviously an area of great diversity, is that we had participants from across all different ages, ethnicities, geographies. And at the beginning, the hospice was quite surprised and wondered whether people would actually come together. But when you begin asking people, how have you experienced loss in your life? And actually that cuts across difference, because everyone can reflect on a bereavement, a loss, a caregiving experience. And we saw some of the most amazing experiences being discussed, and people were talking about things for the first time. And so when you begin having conversations on that level, then you suddenly have a very different response to say, okay, well, actually, what would a response to people on the street or in this local area to help them die well? And once you start at that, then you can build up some very powerful responses.
And here's Richard with the heartwarming last thought.
Recognising that death has value, I think, is very important in all of this. So, you know, death is needed for change and development. The whole of evolution is based on death. And without death, every birth would be a tragedy. And we're sort of hovering on the edge of that already. And the fact that we all die, that life is transient, I think binds us together. And also, very particularly, sitting with the dying teaches us how to die. And in a sense, we're given a gift.
That's a great place to end, if you excuse the pun. I hope that's given you a taste of this year's series of pods. You can still access them wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also email us with your suggestions on issues and guests you'd like to hear in future at podcast@health.org.uk. A huge thank you to Kate Addison and Grace Everest at the Foundation for all their fantastic support on the pod this year, and to Paddy and crew at Malt Productions. Thank you all for listening, and a very Merry Christmas from all of us at the Health Foundation.